Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 240 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life. And today, where did that wellness come from? Yeah, the origins of wellness in places you didn't think about. We've got a terrific show coming up. But before we begin, just know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. Here's your first official reminder to click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show, because we love to hear your feedback. Yes, indeedy do, we do. So, and I'll give you another reminder after the episode is complete. So without further ado, it's time for Her. All right, now, we live in the world of a viral pandemic. And one thing we're all trying to do is to hold on to, if not establish, some kind of a sense of wellness. Yeah, wellness when you're in lockdown, when you're in shelter in place all over this globe while we deal with the fallout from COVID-19. And so here's an interesting twist on all of this. When we talk about wellness, what are we really talking about? So we have Matthew Ingram, who is the author of Retreat, How the Counterculture Invented Wellness. And boy, has he got an interesting background. I mean, just amazing. Throwing raves in West Africa in 1993, writing for Teletubbies. He's a Brit, you know. And then, honestly, his Vitamin C animated documentary, which was shown at the Chicago International Children's Film Festival. Amazing ideas that Matthew wants to share with us about how the counterculture invented wellness. Matthew, welcome to the Her podcast.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Now, where are you right now in this globe? Where are you?
I'm in London, and I'm locked in my, I'm locked in my house with my family. And like the rest of us, you know, doing the best that we can in the situation.
What's it like over there right now? I'll share my USA thing if you'll share your Brit experience.
Absolutely.
Right now.
I'd love to hear what's going on with you as well. But it's I think we're maybe a little bit further down the line than you are in the States. And I think there's a sense that the panic is slightly beginning to subside and people are beginning to get itchy feet, which is probably a good sign, really. But, you know, obviously the news is completely wall-to-wall COVID, and a lot of people are being affected very badly and economically as well, obviously. So it's a serious
wow.
Strange times.
Yeah. And, you know, over here in the USA, so far, all of our states are actually doing fairly well, relatively speaking. We're really way down there on the curve, except for New York City and New Jersey, which are a complete mess. And right now, the good news is New York City is beginning to slowly but surely flatten that curve. And we're seeing less newer deaths and cases. But we really need to get a lot more testing going on here. And everyone here in the United States is in lockdown. So that's a very good thing if we're going to contain this, you know, horrible pandemic that's affected every single country in this world. So what can I say? So what a great time to be talking to you about this issue of wellness and the counterculture. Tell us more about the counterculture of the 60s and the 70s. You know, so many people remember it for everything from music to fashion to art to feminism, and I could go on. But there was a whole wellness thing going on, looking at the healing arts of the East and the West. Tell us about that, Matthew.
Sure. Well, I mean, to start off at the beginning, I guess there is a difference in one sense between wellness as we understand it today, which is, you know, it's from the state often, it's from insurance companies, it's from a general well-being. It's not so much, it doesn't come so much with philosophical trappings or, you know, cultural trappings so much. But in the 60s, which was, and the a lot of the conduit of the Eastern philosophy coming in to the to the culture through the counterculture, meant that this was the first time a lot of people were exposed to meditation and yoga. But equally as well, it was a lot of other things were bubbling under. So, for instance, nowadays people look askance when you mention it, but macrobiotic food, which was deemed as being a kind of a scourge of the society, which now is pretty much reincarnated as veganism. So that was the kind of the diet of the counterculture. It was called the kosher of the counterculture. And then, for instance, there was the whole angle of, controversial angle probably of LSD and its use in therapy. And a lot of the people who we see as being famous figures from the 60s were psychoanalysts or psychiatrists like Timothy Leary and the man who's just died recently, Ram Dass, who was Richard Alpert, who was Timothy Leary's assistant at Harvard. And then, of course, there was the whole political angle to the wellness debate in the 60s and 70s, which was around anti-psychiatry, which was around the idea that mental illness was a myth. So, but all of these currents, although they might seem very disparate, were all tied up with ideas which had come over from India, Japan, and China, as the Tao and Zen and Buddhism. And so that was really the driving force of those ideas of wellness into the counterculture.
How interesting. So I was at the University of California at Berkeley during the 70s. Oh, yeah. And I remember on campus, you know, I was pre-med and science and whatever. I took possibly one of the most amazing courses ever. It was the Tao of Physics. And this was absolutely. And, you know, here he was combining Eastern philosophy with hardcore physics. As, you know, we in science, you know, defined it. And what an interesting take on our ability to be able to look way beyond just the strict metrics of physics and actually look at it in a more universal sense. So that was kind of cool. And then when you look at, well, when you look at things like wellness, as it was defined in the 60s by, as it were, the hippies and the rest of the counterculture, you know, we were the first ones to have co-ops. We had grocery co-ops. Yeah, we were the ones. I remember the Berkeley co-op. We were one of the first ones on the planet to really, you know, go out there and do farm to table and grab farm produce and think about things that weren't processed, et cetera. And of course, everyone thought we were all nuts and, you know, just a bunch of health freaks or something while everyone else was downing, you know, processed chips and dips and crap and back and forth. So I'm curious.
And you're so right that very much the health food drive came, as you say, from that culture.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's flash forward for a second. You know, you're talking about how this 60s movement invented 21st century wellness. What do you mean by that? How did it invent it?
Well, I guess there's an element of the publishers, Random House in America, wanting a snappy title. But I guess in a sense that the ideas that the counterculture brought over, in a sense that nothing is new under the sun, but the ideas which they brought over were essentially an invention for the West. So, I mean, a very good example would be how before, you know, Japan, before in the late 19th century, was, you know, isolated as an isolated state. And then with the American envoys coming over and saying, right, you've got to open up your country to the rest of the world for trade and what have you. At that point, there was a big shift in Japanese culture, whereby the previously existing forms of medicine, which would be not allopathic, I think is the correct way of describing them, would have been about food and the kind of the healing arts of meditation or acupuncture, moxibustion, things like that. All of that previous era of medicine was completely swept to one side, and at the same time was introduced the Western diet, which was based on, I think it's von Liebig's ideas of, that protein was very important, that had to come from animal products. And there's a great story of the American ambassador coming to Japan and asking for a cow for him to milk. And the Japanese literally could not believe it. It was the most outlandish thing they'd ever heard. And because, cattle was used for working the lands, nobody ate large animals. They would eat fish or fowl at the most. So, in terms of a plant-based diet, and this is the foundation of macrobiotics, they were very close. So, in a sense, the macrobiotics movement, which was actually called the Shokukai in Japan, that was actually, macrobiotics was a rebranding of that. That was a kind of a back to the isolation era. With the macrobiotics movement, it was a shift back to that, to those primary ideals of Japanese health and the health of the Orient. And that, in turn, became the revolutionary undercurrent that the hippies took over and embraced. So it was actually a kind of the early traditional, pre-traditional foodstuffs and health techniques of the East. So in terms of it, the invention of it, it was really the use and manipulation of pre-modern techniques of the East in the Western context, in the modern Western context.
Isn't that interesting? Because it makes me remember when those marvelous Brits, the Beatles, began to, embrace transcendental meditation and also a lot of other, elements of Eastern of philosophy as well as Indian, et cetera, and that they were early adopters in that regard. But that also influenced an entire generation, because that's exactly when all of this was going on.
The Beatles were absolutely a constant thread through the book, in the sense that almost every single one of these fields the Beatles were involved in. So it's a Beatles book on many respects.
Oh, there's no question. That is exactly why I brought this up, because, they were, I guess, one of the early, as it were, influencers, is what we call them now. Yeah. And so if they did something, everyone was all over it in 2 minutes. And they were, again, really smart early adopters, always, foraging for a richer experience in trying to understand this whole issue of wellness on the overall. So meditation became cool. It was all right to do that. You weren't some freak or something. Yoga was where it was at. And obviously all the changes in diet. I didn't see any of the Beatles chowing down on a boatload of cheeseburgers, unless I missed that part.
No, you're right. And John Lennon was a big fan of macrobiotic food, because Yoko Ono knew it from Japan. And McCartney had his own land, and he did his own gardening and composting. So it was all, they were right involved in food.
So let's do something really interesting. You know, let's go to today. Here we are in the middle of a global pandemic with a virus that we're just beginning to, as it were, get to know as we, feverishly, in more ways than one, study it and try to survive it. And so how does, what are the gifts that the counterculture wellness, can be applied? Which of these gifts can be applied to how to be able to address on a personal basis, let alone a community basis, what's going on today?
Well, it's a very good question. In terms of, and obviously I'm not, a doctor, a medical doctor like yourself. And so I have to be slightly careful with what I say. But in terms of wellness as an idea, I think, unfortunately, and it's terribly, terribly sad in a way, and it's something that some sections of society would wish weren't the case, or would rather turn a blind eye to. But unfortunately, it's when we're not well that viruses like this can really take us down, or when, for instance, our lifestyle is unhealthy. So, for instance, I know it's a very much a affecting, people's breathing and lungs. So, and obviously, if you smoke, I think there's theories that has hit China so badly because it's the large consumption of tobacco, and obviously there's a lot of environmental pollution there. So, in terms of on the first level, in terms of surviving something like this, it's about becoming more healthy in our day-to-day lives. I have to be quite qualified when I say that. But in terms of surviving the experience that we're all going through now, certainly, yoga and meditation is a great way to spend one's time and to negotiate through this period. We're all stuck at home, isolated, and in fact, if you look at the roots of meditation and the idea of meditation, the idea of yoga, as right from the earliest roots, that kind of isolation is actually the first thing that you need to actually pursue those things successfully. So, for instance, the yogis will go and isolate themselves in makeshift cabins up in the mountains or in caves, so the very idea of a retreat is one where you pull back from society and you find a peaceful space. Well, for better or for worse, a lot of us are having to cope with that situation. So I suppose in a case where if we can tear ourselves away from the internet and tear ourselves away from the television and just as some people perhaps pretentiously say, enter the silence, I think that would be something that the counterculture certainly would endorse as a way of coping with the situation.
Excellent. And this is also, it's interesting, when people are shuttered at home, guess what they start doing that certainly here in the USA, we've been sort of kicking to the curb? Cooking, right? And so, suddenly you're sitting there, first of all, it's a heck of a lot cheaper to just grab some, fresh produce or frozen or, however you do it, and actually do something radical like cook something. It's a lot less expensive than going to a restaurant or even, fast food's not cheap by any means, et cetera. So when you're now penny pinching because maybe you're on furlough or you've been terminated from your job or back and forth, suddenly you get a whole lot more creative about what you're doing out there. And maybe this is an interesting lesson.
It could be a very
lesson.
Interesting. Yes, it could be. It would be a great lesson, wouldn't it, if we could all cook more, certainly.
Well, I think of in the midst of difficulty lies opportunity. What's the lesson here? What's the opportunity? Because no matter how funky things get out there, what are we learning from all this? You know, and it's really quite fascinating. Maybe we can redefine how we live in many respects when we're shuttered, when we're, you know, sheltered in place. How are we living? How are we interacting with others? You still, you know, sticking your nose in your smartphone all day long, or are you actually opening your eyes and dealing with someone else in front of you? Are you getting up and moving? I know that in the United States, I assume it's the same in Britain, but let me know otherwise. You know, we're allowed to get outside, go to the park and walk, obviously keeping, you know, safe distance. But, you know, if you're walking your dog or, you know, just walking for health and back and forth, and really maybe rediscovering using your body in a way you never thought you'd do before. That's kind of cool.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a great opportunity to get access. And it's also in terms for mental health as well, for that sense. But it's almost like having been taken away from us, you know, it's a good opportunity to do it. Unfortunately, in terms of the book, in terms of the research that I've been doing, certainly about the 60s, one of the messages that came through my research was that actually the counterculture was terrible at those things. I mean, it's funny to say the counterculture invented wellness, because in many respects, like with exercise, you know, the meditation certainly was something that was very embraced. But actually, if one actually tries to look for connections to actual yoga, something that actually it happens a little bit later than the counterculture. It's almost a slightly different thing. So all of those things that are, like you say, embodied and healthy, they there's something that the counterculture didn't figure out. And it wasn't actually until, for instance, something like disco came along, where people were getting involved in working out and get fit and actually seeing, you know, the dance floor as somehow, you know, a place to be expressive. So for instance, countercultural figures like Jane Fonda ended up having an impact through workout in the disco era. So, but in terms of it itself, the counterculture, that was something that it really didn't get right. There was a lot of too much drug use and not enough exercise.
Now, you brought up something interesting in the book, and that's how Western society has engineered addiction or attachment as a way of life. You know, what was that all about?
Well, a lot of the Eastern thought that came over was brought over by kind of charismatic Buddhist or Vedantist thinkers, like, for instance, D.T. Suzuki or Chogyam Trungpa, and a lot of these characters, they came over from, you know, India, Tibet, Japan, and they brought with them all these ideas. But a lot of the one thing that really didn't get translate very well, I think, was the idea of attachment, which is obviously a fundamental concept of Buddhism, which is, you know, you avoid the things that you are addicted to, essentially. But the first wave of people who brought these ideas, they felt that they could sell things like meditation as a concept, or you know, they could sell the spiritual idea. But I think quite often the idea of attachment wasn't sold, essentially, to the West. So this is why a lot of the revolt against these ideas in the early 70s by the likes of Christopher Lash, who wrote a very famous book called The Culture of Narcissism, which was explicitly about this kind of self-seeking wellness culture that came from the hippie. A lot of that is very pointedly ethical and moralistic, and saying, you know, essentially pointing out this fact that the idea of attachment and avoiding things that you're addicted to wasn't translated over. And so it's arguable that I certainly see it that when you grasp the idea of the concept of attachment, that And certainly this is borne out by the interviews that I've done with, you know, the gurus, the 60s gurus and the 60s psychiatrists and that I've spoken to, was that they see Western society and modern Western society as sort of blindly addicted to things that they don't, that we almost take for granted. So, for instance, we all, for instance, take alcohol as a given. And I think a lot of us probably drink a bit too much, maybe. And for instance, as well, other aspects of our lifestyle, obviously smoking, but also some kind of foodstuffs that have addictive qualities. So sugar is something. So, for instance, the macrobiotic diet, which is one which was very much, you know, the central diet for the 60s, doesn't have any sugar, and it doesn't have any you know, it doesn't have masses of you know, red meat or more foodstuffs that could be seen as being, you know, having an attraction based on a kind of an addiction. Certainly sugar is the best and most obvious example of that. And so you know, but it goes right across the way. I went to see Germaine Greer and talked to her, the 60s feminist, and one of her big things is pornography, and how she's saying, when will you men get fed up with it? And that's another thing that, again, which is part of a, could be seen as an attachment. So and probably something that's probably not terribly good for people's mental health. But it's all of these addictive things are, you know, have been engineered into a lifestyle in the West, and we don't even seem to notice it anymore.
Well, I love the fact that you've brought this whole issue up about attachment and addiction. You know, I wrote a New York Times best-selling book called The Hunger Fix about food addiction, and clearly, you know, sugar was a major piece of the action there. I mean, these are such incredibly cool points that you're making. Everyone out there in her podcast land, just know that right now, it's important for you to, I know, you're trying to cope with, navigate around the challenges of this global pandemic, wherever you may be out there with the COVID-19 virus. And, you know, it's important for us to, you know, define our own wellness, if anything, redefine it, especially now that we're sheltered in place and in lockdowns. What's it really going to be for you? How are you going to define your own holistic, integrative sense of wellness and well-being and health in this era that is challenging all of us mentally and physically? I'd love for you to go out there and look at Matthew Ingram's book, Retreat, How the Counterculture Invented Wellness. It's absolutely chock full of amazing interviews and new ways for you to think about where this concept of wellness originated, looking at a variety of different philosophies. I think it's just absolutely a fabulous read. And Matthew, I can't thank you enough for being on the Her podcast and sharing your thoughts about this. This is just absolutely fabulous. Again, the name of the book is Retreat, How the Counterculture Invented Wellness. Matthew, I want to thank you for being on the Her podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been an honor. Thank you.
Of course. And take care of yourself over there, you know, in England. And, you know, I pray for your health and safety and that of your family. I hope everything resolves itself over the course of the next couple of months
for all of us. Let's hope so. Thank
Absolutely.
You so much.
Of course. And everyone out there right now, take a minute to hit iTunes and rate and review the show. It was very provocative. Lots of thoughts for you to mull over. Yep, mental marination once again. All right, now we're sitting here waiting to hear from you, so come on down. All right, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Her Podcast. I want you to follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the Her Podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Hey, thanks for listening today. Stay well and stay safe.